Tere Toma, ndwa yinze, ene kiran sope, piki kene gongoni pi, ti tsui mambu, ti ya shabu chi ni ma yinba, daa ti yinze, ene chi gen, ki tu si kalab naa che, ene chan su tu su gaa che, pa tere nye pi, kitaa piki je su yaran ta, ene pi tuji che se nene, Toma nga te shubi yinze.
First of all, I want to congratulate Guruji and all of you for your spending this time in meditation, shamatha, quiescence meditation, not just one or two days, but several months in making such an effort and doing this. I want to rejoice in your merit, and I want to thank you, say thank you very much for doing this, and to Guruji as well.
Chaza ne thola ene nga charan chola tba chi phaya ge ta chi sho gole tene sida ja chembu tang ne charan chol phaya ji ta shu shu hig ma re sam chen ge dus
And what I consented to come today in thinking that perhaps I could say one or two things that might be of benefit to you in your practice. Not that I think that I can do anything extensively to benefit you, but perhaps a little bit.
Ani lhāpa tōyāng, ān ngā rāng tsō chī nāmbē chū kī tēne chī chū sī yāndō bātā, kōng shō gu yāng tēne sī yāndō bātā, ānī chī jiāng rō kōng rō bā, tēsi nī tēlē chāng tēne shū gu gu mā rē sī.
And I don't think that it's necessary, since you are practicing so deeply Buddhism, to talk to you about such things as the excellences of the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha and the process of taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha and the Three Jewels. This sort of thing, I don't think I need to go into with you.
Tare che zang, nye chana chol phaya dhub chi la ngara samta na, ane chi gong jo du chi kol ta phaya ka samba dhub chi.
Therefore,
Na sa tende chi kol ta yasa shu
I
yis.
thought since you were already in process of meditation, there might be a few things I could offer that might be of help to you in your practice of meditation.
Che zang, gong jo la, thoma tene ji meni tsurin sung gwa res.
And I thought to remind you that in regard to the practice of meditation, in the Buddhist traditions, it is fundamental that first one must uphold the proper ethical conduct, sila.
세상에 저랑 저배지 까미야 마송아 쟤는 나제 쟤는 나제 없어 까미야 마송 때 나제 세로 깨자 마시야 까미야 마송 해서 제로와 마치 짓던데 슈고요데 세 두스 진짜 대처 배 추팅 송야다 단어 지레서 등에 세상 야부시나데
I recall that you have been often during the retreat observing silence. And this observation of silence is counted under the heading of observing Shila. And I was impressed by that and wanted to comment on how that fits in the larger view of Shila.
Tā pēnā ngā rāng sō jī ngā rāng gō nē dzūnyū chāma cī tsū sē yā rō tē tē sō sō kī tē nē mā jōngā tē tsāng kī tsū tēng sōng sī kī mā rē sī.
Now, as you know, the four negative or evil karmic paths of speech are lying, backbiting, harsh speech, and frivolous speech. But silence, if it is simply an omission of committing any of those activities, merely not committing them, is not in itself an upholding of ethical conduct, an upholding of Shila.
Tā chāyāsāng chūrīṋ sūngāla kāntacī guvāra sā na āne pēnā ngāng kī gōni dzūñ, chāma, cīcū, ngāche tīndē chē na rāvā mā sūngu tī tīndē chē bī na āne yīmī tā mājē na pēyō bā tī yāpū sāng nī āne sūngu rē sā.
It does not count as an upholding of right Shila or right ethics, ethical action, unless one observes that restraint of lying, harsh speech, and so forth, from the point of view of understanding full well the process of cause and effect of karmic evolution, what are the disadvantages and drawbacks of committing such negative deeds of speech, and what are the advantages and excellences of restraining their commission, or restraining such actions. Only when one upholds the ethical conduct from the point of view of knowing those procedures of karmic causality does it count as the upholding of ethical conduct, of Shila.
Tāpēnā dzūyīn rāba chīla chāshāna
For example, if you take lying as an example,
dzūyīn rāba chīla chāshāna There are
said to be three main degrees of gravity of lies.
This degree
of gravity is usually differentiated on the basis of what is the motive, what is the mental motivation for the commission of the lie.
For
example, one can tell a lie out of desire, one can tell a lie out of hate, one can tell a lie out of delusion. Similarly, if it is a lie that is motivated by a desire, there can be a lie motivated by intense desire, by medium desire, by small desire. Similarly, with anger or hatred, there's the same gradation of three levels.
Now,
depending on how the gravity of the deed is analyzed, how grave the actual deed is, the ripening effect, the fruition of that deed, is threefold. If it is the most extremely grave type of lie, its effect ripens by an existence in future life in a hell. If it is of medium strength or medium gravity, its effect ripens as a future existence in the Pretaloka, the realm of hungry ghosts, as they call it. If it's of light order, its effect is ripened by rebirth as a dumb animal. Now there are further types of effects. Even after one has experienced a whole lifetime in one of those realms, as a fruition of the karma of lying, after having expiated in a sense or exhausted that particular karmic fruition and regaining the high status, the high evolutionary status of humanity and becoming again a human being, there are still further fruitions to be experienced from that single lie in the previous life, one of which is called a corresponding effect, and another which is called an analogous effect. Notice, this comes when you have come back up from hell or Pretaloka or animal realm to the human realm, and these then ripen in your experience.
The analogous
effects emerge on the basis of one's body, the nature effect, the character of one's body and mind in that human life after having been in one of the lower states.
And
the corresponding effect has to do with the circumstances or the region in which one dwells in that life.
For example, what is
one of the analogous effects in relation to the mind? Even though we are born as a human, we have a great liking for lying. We always like to lie. We tend to automatically and spontaneously to tell lies in that future life. That's one of the analogous effects.
Then, me, then, so, so, the then, the chasing, so, so, the
And similarly, the fact that other people seem to enjoy telling lies to one, and people always seem to be deceiving one, this is another kind of analogous effect. In regard to the country and the circumstances of one's dwelling, one has the opposite of a green thumb. Crops never seem to grow. The rain never seems to fall on time. One always has problems of this type with the circumstances of one's abode. This is a a corresponding effect.
For
example, from the seed of a single lie told in a previous life, such elaborate effects emerge, and for each of the negative paths of speech, such as backbiting, gossiping, such as harsh speech, abusive speech, that is, some such as frivolous speech or blasphemous speech, these four types of speech, each of them have a very elaborate possible types of fruition which are developed in the scriptures on the basis of a single seed of a single lie told in a single life. Similarly, all are the same in that their main evolutionary effect is that they entail a rebirth in one of the three lower states, depending on gravity, first. And there are analogous and corresponding effects then have specific types of effects on one's inner constitution and the external circumstances of one's living. When one returns to the human realm. For example, it is said that if one's dwelling place somehow always seems to be a mess, it always seems to be surrounded by garbage, and somehow even though things which to somebody else might be useful objects become a cluttered kind of junky kind of mess around wherever one lives, if one tends to accumulate, this is said to be the corresponding effect of previous harsh speech in previous lives, of having engaged in abusive speech in previous lives.
Now,
and if one tends to accumulate unnecessary objects and have objects which really are completely useless, but somehow they continually gravitate to one, they break down, one has a great propensity for useless objects. This is a corresponding effect of previous lives' commission of frivolous speech, useless speech. And if one has a credibility gap with people, that whatever one says, however sincerely and earnestly and truthfully one speaks to people, they somehow never believe one, this is a corresponding effect of having previously committed a lot of lies. If one studies the cause and effect of karma in this way in detail and comes to understand the precise types of experiences, unpleasant experiences in this life that ripen from having committed, from committing negative paths of speech, negative speech acts, then one restrains oneself from committing those types of acts of speech in the present on the basis of knowing the drawbacks, of seeing the causes that will arise from that act.
And then it's excellent.
And similarly, there's a way of seeing the positive side of not committing those acts and committing the opposites of them, such as telling truth instead of lying and so forth. And here, the opposite of the acts, of the negative speech acts or the positive acts, the strongest one, the most powerful one is born in heaven in a future life. The mediocre one is born in the titan or demigod realm, and in the smaller, the inferior one, but still excellent one is reborn as a human being.
And
similarly, the corresponding effects and analogous effects of these positive acts of telling the truth, of making peace between, reconciling conflicts between people, of speaking meaningfully and of speaking gently and sweetly, the four opposites of the negative ones, corresponding and analogous effects of those four are similarly that in the circumstances of one's life and in one's constitution in those future lives, one will be excellent even if for some other reason one is reborn even in a lower state, one will be reborn excellently. If one is reborn as a deer, it'll be as a handsome deer and a strong deer and a nice deer country and so forth. These things will affect the circumstances of one's dwelling and one's constitution accordingly.
Therefore,
it is excellent if in the process of practicing silence in your retreat, if you think in terms of the fact that in restraining the habitual negative paths of speech, that one is doing so on the basis of knowing, of beginning to assess the negative karmic effects of committing such acts and assessing the positive benefits of not committing those acts, and on the basis of that knowledge, one is consciously upholding a certain shila or ethical conduct, then that silence becomes even more powerful. For example, from the point of view of body, as you know, the tenfold path of karma is that not to kill, not to take what is not given to you, that is steal, and not to commit sexual misconduct. These are the three paths, negative paths of body to be restrained. This has a similar type of analysis where, for example, beings who have prematurely lose their lives, who have a shortened lifespan, this comes from taking the lives of other beings in previous lives as a corresponding effect. For example, the continuous affliction with poverty, or even if one has possessions, somehow they become shabby when one owns them, they lose their luster. This kind of experience, continuous experience, has to do with the corresponding effect of previous theft in previous lives, taking what was not given.
And dirty, messy environment
is the corresponding effect of previous sexual misconduct in previous lives.
A lot of divorce and betrayal
and unfaithful infidelity of others committing up against one has to do with one's own previous infidelities and the sexual misconducts in previous lives.
And the fact
that one's possessions, things, objects, hi-fi sets, cars, and so forth seem to always break down, fall apart, they never seem to have reached their expected usefulness has to do with the being the analogous effect of previous theft. So in that kind of way, there are countless and complex analysis of the cause and effect of evolution. One can come to see kind of the pattern of how experiences occur to one in this way. And then when one sees that and it becomes aware, therefore, of one's own responsibility for one's own misfortunes, then one becomes very attentive to upholding ethical conduct very precisely and very energetically. For example, if you make a wooden wheel, it is said that the hub of that wheel is shila, or ethical conduct. If we're talking about one's practice, one's dharma practice, the practical dharma, as a wooden wheel, its hub is shila, or ethical conduct. Now, if we turn to the subject of meditation,
Now we'll talk about the
focus of mindfulness, the stations of mindfulness, and we'll talk about them on the basis of six topics. And this, there's a danger that this will be helpful to you.
First is the
object of attention in mindfulness.
temba nyara mi pati che
lawless
de chugo de temba nyara ngo de che
second is the temba nyara shakpati
ngo
second is the actuality of the mind of mindfulness of focusing mindfulness
that ni ku namba de che ngo de
then it's the aspect or form of that mind Then the need of the four foci of mindfulness or stations of mindfulness. Then the etymology of the expression Smriti Upasthana.
Sakapasthana
in Pali. What? Then the associates or the accompanying attitudes and minds of the foci of mindfulness. These are the six headings under which the subject of the foci of mindfulness is usually taught. Now the objects are of course body, mind, feelings or sensations, and phenomena. These are the same as one is usually familiar with. What is the reason for picking these objects as primary objects for the focusing mindfulness upon? It is because in our usual habitual way of living, our body is a tremendous focus of concern, if not obsession with us.
It is Now,
it is the place in which we exist. We have the attitude toward that it is our indispensable ground of existence, our body.
The mind,
we identify with the mind as being our actual self. The sensations we identify as being our major foci or focus of experience. That is where we invest all our attention and we consider our almost exclusive experience to be in pleasant and unpleasant sensations. And phenomena are the basis of the whole thing. Therefore, the foci of mindfulness picks the four, these four objects of the foci of mindfulness, primarily. Our abode, our body, our mind, our self, our feeling, our sensations as our experience, and phenomena as the basis of our dwelling.
Now,
as far as the outer body and the inner body and so forth, these you all understand. The analysis of the body into external and internal. As far as sensations goes, you have pleasure, pain, and indifferent sensations that you're aware of. There are then within the pleasant sensations, there are pleasant sensations relating to the different senses. Six senses relating to the different types of faculties. It's subdivided in the nervous system in a certain way. This you must be familiar with. Now the mind itself, it has its three synonyms of mind, mentality, and consciousness, or citta, manas, and vijnana. Sixfold group of consciousness, meaning the visual, audio, olfactory, gustatory, tactile, and mental consciousnesses, those six. Then, as far as phenomena goes, Dharma, the fourth category, all phenomena that are not sugmayimba.
Zudi lyug dang do sarwa ta sen des do sarwa choa den do sarwa ta te mayim bi ta duje tangje de.
All compounded phenomena that are not material, that are not consciousness, that are not sensations, go into the category of dharmas. mental objects in that sense. The ideas are important there.
Dang wo de la, zhenpa ni ge wo de la, du shi de.
So that's the first section, the section of the object. Sache dampu de wa.
Zhe wa.
Nimate
wo. Wo de la
sen. The second is the actuality of the mind of the foci of mindfulness, second category.
Sen jung nga chu tsa chi ge de zhenpa de hirou ni de yo re.
And these are two of the 51 mental functions. In the Abhidharma system, as you know, there are mental functions, although different systems have slightly different number. In our system, there are 51. Two major of the 51 are motivated in the foci of mindfulness. These two that are crucial are that of the mental function of mindfulness, smriti, and the mental function of wisdom, or prajna, discriminative wisdom. The companions, jumping to the sixth topic of this main two mental functions that are mobilized in the practice of the foci of mindfulness, are the five ubiquitous mental functions and the five object-determining mental functions, which you've probably heard of. Now, what are the ways, the aspects in which the mind concentrates on the different objects? First, if we take this is the third topic for explaining this subject. If we take the body, the first aspect under which the body is contemplated is the body as impure. The body is contemplated as impurity. The feelings or sensations are contemplated as suffering.
How are the
sensations contemplated as suffering? They are painful sensation is contemplated as the suffering of suffering. A pleasant sensation is contemplated as the suffering of change. And the general sensational structure is contemplated as the cosmic suffering of compounding, of compoundment, of creation.
Happiness
is changeable suffering. Suffering is the suffering of suffering. And indifferent sensation is the all pervasive creational suffering. So this is the way in which in Buddhism all things fit into, that is why the First Noble Truth is that all things are suffering, it relates to this type of way of fitting in all phenomena. Now in regard to the mind, the major aspect under which one must be mindful of the mind is under its aspect of impermanence. As the body, the main aspect was impurity, the feelings or sensations, the main aspect was painfulness. The mind, the main aspect is impermanence. Now, amongst dharmas or phenomena, those which are the phenomena associated with the purification, those phenomena are to be accepted, undertaken, cultivated. The phenomena that are associated with addiction or affliction, kleshas, they are to be abandoned. The phenomena are to be discerned and divided into these two types. There are two ways of meditating, of course, in relation to these phenomena. One is known as the meditating them under their specific or particular characteristics, and the second is meditating them under their general characteristics. This is what I've just outlined, is the specific character or particular characteristic of the four foci, to meditate them under their particular characteristics. If we do in general meditate them under the general characteristic, we contemplate on the seals of the Dharma, namely the first being that all compounded phenomena are impermanent. The second, that all contaminated phenomena are suffering. Third, that all phenomena are selfless. And fourth, that there is no peace that is worthwhile other than nirvana. This is known as the general characteristic way of contemplating the churangi de
migyan.
I'm sorry, not all four of the foci, but this is the general characteristic way of contemplating the foci of mindfulness on the Dharma, the fourth of them only.
The divine.
This is the way of contemplating things in general, not of mindfulness in general, not focusing specifically on any of the four objects. Now, the fourth topic, the need or necessity of meditating of the on the foundations of mindfulness,
is
one has to come to an understanding of the way in which the samsara comes into being and the way in which the samsara is reversed and one emerges from the samsara. This is the purpose of meditating on the foundations of mindfulness, understanding the way of entry and the way of exit of the samsara. For example, the four truths are taught under the aspect that the truth of suffering must be acknowledged, the truth of causation or origination must be abandoned, the truth of cessation must be realized, and the truth of the path must be practiced. They are taught under this way, for example.
Therefore,
in contemplating the four foundations of mindfulness, these four imperatives that the Buddha gave to his disciples in the context of teaching them the four holy truths are to be achieved and will emerge from the meditation on the four foundations of mindfulness. For example, if one reflects upon the impurity of the body, the ugliness of the body, one will come to develop a sense of the suffering of physical existence, and one will then develop a strong desire to become separated from that type of suffering, free of that suffering. When one contemplates the suffering of sensations and one realizes the all-pervasiveness of suffering in one's sensory experience, one will realize how that suffering is generated by one's habituation to desire and attachment and craving, and one will attain a strong wish to become free of that kind of desire, attachment, and craving. If one analyzes the mind to understand its nature of impermanence, when one realizes deeply the impermanence of the mind, in the observation of the mind, one loses the naive notion of the permanence of the mind of this life, and hence loses the presumption that at the end of this life, consciousness will be terminated. One loses that nihilistic view that one holds, and one recognizes that as the mind of this life is an impermanent continuum, so the mind at the end of this life will be a continuum, and the mind at the end of the samsara will be a continuum, and one there is therefore a possibility of attaining nirvana. This for the first time truly dawns as a graphic possibility to one after realizing the impermanence of the mind, the third of the foci of mindfulness.
Notice.
And when one realizes and discriminates between different phenomena, dharmas, and sees some of them as worthy of undertaking, worthy of involvement, as being those things to be accepted, and others as being those things to be abandoned, when one develops that type of discrimination and understands what is to be practiced and what isn't to be practiced, at that time one comes to a real realization of the fourth holy truth, the truth of the path, the Eightfold Path.
제상 두스레스
다든 where they are laid out these four false mindfulness
다 다세드 카레스나
now finally the fifth category of topic the etymology of the foci of mindfulness is smritipatthana or satipatthana in pali
변은 르센추 대유 대미바 예보텔로 아니 랑기 잼바데 텔바 따니 냐와 잡아나 잼바니 자스 다 두슬라고
노
르단 센추 예요로 미바게 텔로 테는 베 잼바데네 네비나 아니 잼바 냐와 잡아스
노레스
두슬로 와 잼바
it is upasthana means to place them close upon and that says to focus close upon focus mindfulness closely upon body sensations mind and dharmas and or phenomena and therefore that is the upasthana means to place closely upon or focus closely upon the mindfulness upon those four things that's the etymology of smriti which means mindfulness upasthana which means to place close upon upasthana
jesa ta tema nyawa jala tema nyawa jala tene pe pigiti deguare se tema te higense neta pige
Now, in order to be able to focus the mindfulness closely, one must have the two mental functions known as mindfulness, smriti, and samprajanya, alertness or vigilance. Now, the mindfulness must have, it is said, three kinds of distinguishing characteristics.
That temba chiji sunde de kares na
one of the three distinguishing characteristics of a proper mindfulness
kan ji bi ngup la mi pa sa
no
ha man ji de ne ngup de la mi pa sa
nga man de den
de ji ji de ta telo pa kang ba da ban dro de ne ngup de la mi gu re se yo re ta kan ji bi ngup nga de ji bu shi da yo se nga de chang bu shi da yo ji bu shi da yo se ma le kan ji bi ngup la mi pa sa
one must be mindful
ji se ya de
The mindfulness must be focused on objects that are familiar to one from before. And the mind must be not distracted. And one must not be forgetful. And not distracted. These are the three. Now, your usual objective in your meditations, as taught by Guruji, these you, for example, must not forget. They must be familiar to you so that you can always remember them. So that you can always be picking up on some new objects here and there at random. And they must not be forgotten. This is not a not forgetting that has to do with if we hear some from someone we can repeat it later and remember it. It is a mind that must be able to stay with the objective of concentration. And non-distraction is, of course, not to lose hold of the object that one is focused upon. Those are known as the three qualities of mindfulness. The mindfulness endowed with these three qualities should be like a rope. This rope is what moors one's consciousness to the object to which one is concentrating. And of course, the consciousness is like a wild elephant who has to be moored or attached to that object by the rope. Now, vigilance, samprajanya, the faculty of vigilance further in addition is like the elephant tamer's or elephant trainer's goad hook. with which he kind of pokes the elephant, keeping it from going too much off in any direction.
제가 희귀생의 가르에서나
What is this one?
연대에게 딱 초다 매초 나인 희귀들 희귀에서.
Vigilance is the knower of what is what is allowed and what is not allowed, what is proper and what is improper. In regard to the mental function.
또나 공조의 지전적인 어 늦은 조금의 상상도.
For example, when one is meditating and something else arises in the mind, vigilance is that which watches over those things that arise and evaluates whether they're worthwhile or not worthwhile. And if they're not, they dismisses them. Certain thing, if arising is a useful thing to reflect, it, which will strengthen one's focus of mindfulness, then vigilance allows that. So vigilance is this kind of watchman or guardian of the process of mindfulness.
다음 코닉 중디아들로 지원다 거바스 다코베 카테르 자슈디다
Now, the two major, of course, obstacles to the focus of mindfulness are naturally depression and elation, or sinking and excitement, as some people call it. Excitement or elation comes out of desire and attachment. One is not content with the object one has in mind, and one thinks of some other wonderful thing to think about, and just rises up excitedly to contemplate that. Depression is some kind of obscurity, some kind of stupefaction. The mind cannot stand on its object, but it sinks away from it. And vigilance also is, these are the two major obstacles that vigilance is always on the lookout for, something that will lead to excitement or something that will lead to depression. These, of course, I'm sure that Guruji has told you thoroughly about. And you have to remember these without forgetting them clearly to proceed in your practice.
다 토타니를 자완이 있어. 다 근데 토타니를 자완이 있어. 토마토 타완 타만니들 자완이 요래서.
Now it is said there are two another Tibetan proverb is that there are two things to do, one in the beginning and one at the end. One begin first and one last.
대배 취재에 그 배조로부터 대대에서 취재하고 조로부터 대고.
These are principle for those who are practicing the Dharma.
주공적이나 관념적이나
praying or meditating or doing some virtue or whatever it is,
토막근후도 주고.
First, you have to construct, you have to examine your motivation.
타마든 배 홍아담 편안대야.
Finally, you have to dedicate your merit.
드니드 배 희락 배 조드.
These two are principle in the in assuring the progress of any dharma practice.
토마토는 권후 마취했진 다지 고조든 대바이나 취임이
First if you do not examine your motivation and just go out and meditate or do some practice then it's not necessary that it will become dharma practice whether it has the form of it or not.
취생의 대자와 체마 편체의 삼바 지그세
Dharma is defined in all traditions as that kind of action which is motivated by at least a concern for the future life. At least the minimal boundary is that a concern beyond the goals of this life. For example, in the, amongst Buddhist Dharma practitioners, there are said to be three degrees, grades of practitioners, the smaller, the mediocre, and the superior. The inferior or beginner level of the practice is therefore one who has a genuine awareness of the future life and have genuine fear of being born in the wretched or lower states of existence in the future life and therefore makes effort in this life to practice those practices that will assure a rebirth again in the human realm or better in the demigod or godly realms. And if one, for example, takes refuge in the three jewels out of a motivation of wishing, of out of a fear of potential hellish states of existence, and therefore a wish to be saved from those states, then one is taking refuge as the beginning kind or the lowest inferior kind of Buddhist practitioner.
Mm-hmm. 코아다 내송고 동해 참아지
The middle type of practitioner of the Dharma is one who has recognized the suffering inherent in human existence and in the divine existence, and therefore no longer entertains any kind of illusion about the pleasantness of a future human or heavenly existence, and therefore not only wishes to achieve a good rebirth in a future life, but wishes to achieve liberation from all states of rebirth. For himself alone. The superior type of person is the person who has that kind of view, but who before even achieving that liberation becomes reaches a degree of madness of throwing away, in a sense, their entire life or entire mind by reflecting upon the fact that every other being has a similar need to be liberated from all rebirths, from all sufferings, and therefore has the wish to attain a liberation for himself or herself that is simultaneously a liberation of all other beings, hence a desire only to attain Buddhahood. That is considered the superior type of practitioner. We call this the Bodhisattva, of course, the practitioner of Mahayana. You must understand that we detach this from usual sectarian affiliations. For example, we consider that there are innumerable bodhisattvas within the various groups, the 18 schools of the Theravada, Mahasanghika, etc., all of the different Nikaya schools of early Buddhism, we consider there to have been many innumerable bodhisattvas. So affiliation with a Mahayana school is not necessarily concomitant with bodhisattvahood and vice versa. Therefore, we feel that it is perfectly acceptable to generate a motivation that simultaneously wishes the liberation of all other beings along with one's own liberation to engage in the practice of any of the schools of Buddhism. And not only is it all right, but it is preferable as one's practice achieves a much greater degree of intensity with that kind of motivation. If one does not examine, of course, one's motivation before one engages in the practice of meditation, then it is very difficult, if one were perhaps practicing meditation out of a purpose in this life, somehow I want to be cooler or happier, or I want to be calmer, I want something, some benefit or profit in this life, then it is does not go as Dharma practice. It is not categorized as Dharma practice. There is a difference between Dharma and virtue. To be really a practice of Dharma, it must, to fit in with the Dharma jewel, it must be one of these three types of motivations. Beyond the death of this life, it must have its orientation. And therefore, if the same practice with the larger motivation becomes a larger practice, so we might as well, since we're spending so much effort, do the larger practice out of the same practice by having the larger motivation. I was just telling you something that I think about, just because I thought it might help you. Now we come to the final topic. We're getting close to the time, but we're coming to the final topic. That is that usually we have a kind of mind that thinks of ourselves as extremely precious. We have a mind that is known as the mind of self-cherishing. Don't you think it would be interesting and excellent if we were able to cherish others and consider them as some kind of very important phenomena in the way in which we cherish ourselves and consider ourselves to be such highly important phenomena? Therefore, it's good to cherish others. Here, at this point, and we're entering a vast topic very rapidly, but here at this point, the question always arises to people who are used to the usual egotistical habit of the world, saying, is it possible really to cherish others?
And the
answer to this is that, of course, if one meditates and cultivates one's mind and trains one's mind to cherish others, then one will come to spontaneously cherish others in the same way we now spontaneously cherish ourselves. Shanti Deva, the writer of the Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, the great text of the practice, has said,
He
has proved this with his example in the Bodhicharya Avatara. He has said that all of us, first of all, will accept as fact that all of us cherish our own bodies in the most tremendous manner. We will do the slightest little thing that happens, a little pin or a thorn or a splinter, and we'll just do everything to get rid of that. And we're completely assured of the importance and the essentiality of our own bodies. But this attitude that we have, which we consider natural and spontaneous, is not natural and spontaneous. It is something we have learned, which we can prove to ourselves by looking at an infant's body who does not identify it as themselves yet, who doesn't know a handful's over here, they have no idea. Therefore, our sense now that we think is second nature or first nature about our body is something that is completely learned, it's completely conditioned. We have become habituated so much so that now we clutch our body with absolute spontaneous activity. Since we can get so spontaneous in that action by something that is learned and trained, if we relearn and retrain, we can so feel about the bodies of others. Similarly, Shantideva advances the example of some sort of object, for example, your favorite shirt, your favorite belt. If somebody comes and puts your favorite cashmere sweater in the washing machine, you totally freak out. But at one point, that shirt, that sweater, was just something sitting in a store with a price tag on it that you just looked at casually and paid no attention to. Now you feel as if it was part of you that was shrunk and distorted. So if we learn to, therefore, that proves that about things that we at one point identify as other, as alien, as having no concern of ours, we can come to learn to train ourselves to consider them very much part of ourselves. This is the famous meditation which we were asked to talk about, of the exchange of self and other in the most briefest terms. This is known as the exchange of the famous meditation of the spirit of enlightenment, of love and compassion, known as the exchange of self and other, especially taught by Shantideva. Therefore, for example, you all are making a great hardship. You all are meditating and renouncing many kinds of involvements of temporarily and activities. And if you do that and do it just out of a way of continuing your cherishing of yourself, or which we all habitually have, of thinking this is something important for me, who is important, then your whole practice and all of your effort will have a small outcome finally. So instead of that, combine your practice with a mind of cherishing others and think of and motivate yourself so that you are doing that, so that you can do so much to benefit others, and in that way you will get a great benefit out of it. And therefore you should examine and construct your motivation that you are doing for the benefit of all sentient beings. And also don't forget, when you think all sentient beings, don't forget to include the beings who are right here in front of you, who are right here interconnected with you. If they bug you and bother you, don't sort of leave them out and think of all beings as over somewhere else. Remember that all these beings here are part of all beings. All beings begins at home.
No. Why is
it we have to meditate for the sake of all beings? If one does meditate for the sake of all beings,
The
purpose of meditating for the benefit of all beings is not, of course, to be able to rush out right away and become a distraction to one's meditation and one's running around after all living beings. Obviously, before one has eliminated all of one's own faults and achieved all of one's potential excellences, which is the definition of Buddhahood, then one cannot really do anything effective for other living beings. But if one is seeking to remove all of one's faults and achieve all of one's excellences on the motivation that one needs to do that in order to benefit other living beings, it gives an added pressure and an added intensity to one's motivation. One is seeking this excellence and seeking to remove these faults, not just for one's own sake, but for the sake of all beings who need the kind of help of beings who have eliminated their faults and achieved their excellences.
Therefore,
this is the way to generate one's motivation at the beginning. And similarly, at the end of your sessions of practice, it is also crucial, it is also part of expanding the stream of one's practice to take whatever one may have achieved and accomplished in that practice, whatever merit may have come from one's striving in that practice, and dedicate that as well to the benefit of all living beings. What is called parinamana, or turning over the merit to the benefit of others. Notice, if one was not to have given away by dedication to all beings the merit or virtue of one's act, it's a great fault. For example, you practicing shamatha, mental quiescence, you get much virtue from this. If you don't dedicate it and turn it over to all beings, and you keep it, and when you get mad at some other time, then your root of virtue, since you've been keeping it in your own storage, so to speak, and you become filled with anger, it becomes poisoned within you. And you lose that root of virtue. But if you dedicate it, give it away, and I give it out to all beings, your virtue, instead of righteously grasping it to yourself, then if even you get mad, or if you do some non-virtue at some other time, since the virtue was already given away to everyone else, then the virtue has not been spoiled. Therefore, it is if you have developed some capital from your practice, some capital of virtue or merit, and you've built up this capital through your hard effort, and instead of keeping the capital under your mattress, where you might ruin it by some other act or it might be destroyed, you take it and put it in the bank of the needs of all living beings, and there it's safe and will increase. That is what is called dedication or parinamana, turning over. And it is said that the fruit of that capital of merit which has been put to the stock of all beings is inexhaustible. It increases, it appreciates inexhaustibly. Up until one attains Buddhahood. So now I'm leaving, the time seems to have come up, Balanas. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you on this auspicious day, you through your meditation who have made this possible. And I congratulate and rejoice in your practice. And I say thank you to Guruji. I congratulate and rejoice in his virtuous activity of teaching you. Nowadays, in these days of the five corruptions of the Kali Yuga, everybody's character is so filled and pervaded with the addictive emotions, suffering from them. At that time, to see so many people gathered to concentrate on the mental quiescence, on purifying their mind stream from the mental addictions, even to hear about it is something that gives one joy. It's wonderful. And you all are truly fortunate. You have good kalpas. law.
계산하러 야부지 야부 중네.
Even if you have one good day, it is a fantastic virtue in the whole scheme of evolution.
그러나 미스치시로 때문에 미스치시 사건은 맨 못해만 뭐 제와만 뭐 요아래서.
로 미스
미스치시.
Massachusetts, isn't it? Oh, Massachusetts. Oh, Massachusetts. I thought it was Tibet. Forget it.
Massachusetts.
There are many millions of people in Massachusetts. And there must be very few who are gathered together and calming down their usual life train and meditating in this way. Therefore, you have tremendous merit even to have reached here. That's really excellent. And Guruji, please keep teaching them excellently. And that's it. And, but you wanted to have some questions, perhaps 5 minutes. I know we're a little bit late.
Please, there's 5 or 10 minutes as you like.
You stop the questions, will you please, Jack, so that we know, don't go through and drive the cook crazy. The language in Jacob Kate Yorba, Jackson Shaggy Yona, and it didn't take a Jebu Mambo, she put the Tungi Yona. Ta Gang Chick de Julia, Chick Hako Sona, Yuba Lansona, Shakwa Chitsona, Tarung, Jebu de Tungres, Chick Sorabachi Yor, Maribes.
The Tungo Maris.
No, it's not necessary that you cannot prevent the effects arising that would arise if you didn't take attention to it. The way of understanding of the karmic causality of the ripening of negative actions and positive actions, this sort of details of evolution as taught in the karmic system, is to understand how the sin or an evil action will give fruition, like the seed of a tree, giving the whole tree and then all the many fruits, bad fruits that will grow on that poison tree, in order to get one to take seriously the whole pattern of evolution, what is the nature of life. But once one understands that, the power of a virtuous action, which goes to prevent that tree from giving that poisonous fruit, to detoxify that tree, to purify that, is also very powerful. And in fact, the power of repentance, the power of purification, the power of cutting the root through meditation and wisdom is extremely great, and therefore those fruitions, negative fruitions, can be prevented. That's about it. Yes? Selflessness means the selflessness of all things, means that things have no intrinsic, self-substantial, self-sufficient essence as we habitually perceive them to have. If we seek things, when we see something in front of us that we think is a thing that seems to appear to us intrinsically, self-substantially appear to us, when we seek it, we cannot find any intrinsic substance to it. So that in things which we seek, thinking that that's what it is, and fail to find, that is what is called the self of the thing, and the fact that we fail to find it is indicated by what is called the selflessness of that thing. For example, we must not say there is no self in things. There is a self in things. There is a self in things that involves their relative, mutual relativity. The interdependence of things is their self. But when we see something, or when we experience ourselves, we don't feel that we are just a relativity, a combination of causes and conditions. We feel that we are some sort of independent, self-sufficient thing that somehow rises out without depending on anything else. And that is the self which cannot be found, and that is the self that we lack, hence we are selfless of. That's the way one must think.
One
must think about oneself in application introspectively to oneself. The best way of seeing this, of course, is not just when one is calm, because when one is calm, one will sort of think that one is kind of not there, one is floating there, and I don't have a strong sense of self, I feel self is fine. But then one gets mad at somebody, somebody infuriates one, then suddenly there is something inside one that feels completely independent. It is just there. It's just going on its own. It is carrying one with it. At that time, if one can turn around and observe what is it that I feel inside that it seems to be self-sufficiently independently established, then that is the self which is based on an error which is absent. And that is, and to realize that it is absent is the realization of selflessness.
If you think about it, look about
how you see things. Connected to what you see in front of you, for example. That's, however, perhaps easier than the self inside.
For example,
when you see someone, you see just their head, and you think, oh, I'm seeing him. I've seen him himself. But his head is not him. Of course, depending upon his head, among other parts, then there is such a thing as him. And similarly, the him that comes, the him that goes, the him that says hello, that doesn't say hello, all of this depends upon his head. His head is interconnected with that. But we feel as if, even just seeing the head, that we found something which is the real him, himself. So that's the thing we sort of point to, we sort of deal with, we designate with our term, but with his name, we think it's the real thing. But that thing is not there. It's just all these interdependent pieces and parts. Wherever you touch your finger, you say, okay, yeah, I know he's there, and he's here. But wherever you put your finger, that will not be him. He's there, but wherever you try to put your finger on him, it will not land on him. Mm. It'll land on his head, or his arm, or his hand, or his idea, or his name. This is kind of the way of reflecting about it. For example, we ourselves, when the hand is hurts, we say, I hurt, I have a pain.
And I
do have a pain. And I am sick. But actually, the hand is not me. There's more to me than the hand. But when the hand is sick, we say, I'm sick. So the I, the self, is some weird dependently designated thing like this. It is dependently designated on the five aggregates. It's simply designated there. That's why the Buddha was always saying things like such and such is just a prajnapti, it is just a designation, it is just a designation. It is just said to be so, it's conventional. But some people, the great danger here is not to misunderstand the mere designatedness of phenomena as meaning their non-existence. The self is not non-existent. The I am not non-existent. I am just designated and not absolutely existent. That's a good question.
Sadhu,
sadhu, sadhu. Lexo, stevri. Sanskrit ke liya.
Beautiful talk.
No. That color here.
Excellent translation. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.